Welcome to today's program titled Injunction, Primer, and Discovery in Trade Secrets, Non-Competes, and Computer Fraud. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, type your question in the available box, and click send. To access the handout materials, select the Handouts tab in the Conference Materials pod on the left-hand side of your screen. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form sent with the login information email. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. At this time, I would now like to turn it over to our speakers, Justin Beyer, James Yu, and Dawn Mertonite. You may begin.
Hello, and welcome to the seventh installment of Seyfarth Shaw's 2014 Trade Secret Webinar Series. This particular webinar will be covering the ins and outs of prosecuting and defending trade secret injunction cases. Before we get started with the material, briefly we wanted to introduce ourselves. My name is Justin Beyer. I'm a partner in the Chicago office focusing my practice in trade secrets, computer fraud, and non-competes. Dawn Mertonite, our second speaker, is a managing associate in our Boston office who also focuses her practice in trade secrets, computer fraud, and non-competes. And finally, James Yu, a partner in our New York office, will be speaking on a variety of topics and also focuses his practices in trade secrets, computer fraud, and non-competes. What we are going to cover today, we're going to cover about seven topics in total. First, we're going to help define what is a trade secret. Second, we're going to define what trade secret misappropriation constitutes. We're going to then cover steps employers can take to protect their trade secrets and confidential information. Fourth, we're going to give our best practice tips on what employers should do if they suspect theft. Fifth, we'll focus on best practices for prosecuting a trade secret matter to the extent that an employer has determined that its former employee or current employee has misappropriated any secrets. Sixth, we'll cover what employers should do when hiring competitors' employees, taking a bit of a shift from the prosecution piece. And finally, we're going to talk about strategic considerations for employers to consider if they are sued for trade secret theft. What is a trade secret? Well, in the United States, the Uniform Trade Secret Act has been the primary definer of that. It's been adopted in 48 of 50 states, including District of Columbia and Puerto Rico. The only exceptions to that are Massachusetts and New York. The Uniform Trade Secret Act defines a trade secret to mean information, including a formula, pattern, compilation, program, device, method, technique, or process that, one, derives independent economic value, actual or potential, from not being generally known to and not being readily ascertainable by proper means by other persons who can obtain economic value from its disclosure or use, and two, is subject to efforts that are reasonable under the circumstances to maintain its secrecy. We're going to unpack a couple of those terms, including what it means to derive independent economic value, what it means to be not being generally known to the public, and what it means for reasonable circumstances to maintain secrecy. But at a broad base level, a trade secret is not does not need to be novel or unique. It doesn't need a registration to be filed. In fact, most often you would not anticipate having a copyright or trademark or patent registration. It's generally not published to the public in, you know, in written form. It does not have to be exclusive to one business. A trade secret can actually be owned or possessed by more than one person. And it may be made up of things that are not themselves trade secrets, such as a compilation of publicly available information that, when put together, creates a new piece of information that has independent economic value. Some examples of trade secrets include formulas, manufacturing processes, blueprints and engineering drawings, software and databases, business and marketing plans, customer lists, including customer information and preferences. It can also include contracts with an employer's customers. It can include compensation plans or sales information for employees. There are a wide variety of things that can constitute a trade secret. As we discussed before, one of the keys for trademark for a piece of information to be defined as a trademark, it has to derive value, and it has to be independent and provide a competitive advantage. And what it means by competitive advantage is the question an employer or a company can ask is this information something that I do not want in the hands of a competitor? It has to have economic value. In other words, that if this information were in the hands of a competitor, that competitor could turn around, use that information, and derive an economic benefit from it. And it has to be actual or potential. For example, if you have put a proposal in front of a potential customer, that would be potential value to a competitor. However, if it was a business plan from 5 to 10 years ago, that no longer may have actual or potential competitive advantage or provide value. Additionally, the information must not be generally known. And what that means is that you could not Google the question to the answer, or sorry, you cannot put into the computer or easily find the answer to the question that's being posed. For example, you may have sales information related to 2013 and the margins and the discount rates that were applied on the sales of a particular product. Obviously, that's information that would be closely held in a corporation and would not be something that the corporation would want to be shared with a competitor. Moreover, if that information is being protected, it would not generally be known to individuals outside of the organization. And axiomatic with that is that information can provide economic value from disclosure or use to a competitor from whom that information is intended to be withheld. What are some of the reasonable efforts that are necessary to maintain secrecy? Well, from the outset, we must make clear that reasonable efforts does not mean that information can never be disclosed in any way, shape, or form. One of the best methods to protect that information and one of the leading indicators that a court is going to look for is whether or not a company has confidentiality agreements with its employees. Additionally, and more often, courts are now looking for whether that information is secure. They're looking for password protection, email and electronic data policies, confidentiality reminders on screens and documents, limiting access to those employees who need access to information. And that last one, actually, and two of those last points are worth repeating, and that's marking documents as confidential. Far too often, documents, we see companies have highly, highly sensitive information, particularly with relation to pricing or sales information that may be distributed to a wide base of employees, a sales force, for example, which is information that it would not want a competitor to have. Unfortunately, in many instances, those documents are not actually marked as confidential. So marking documents as internal use only or confidential, not to be disclosed outside the company are things that can be added as footers to documents and should be. Additionally, limiting access is another point that's worth stressing. if a CEO has access to certain information, that shouldn't be available on a database that anyone else in the organization can access. Additionally, while not always necessary, companies do need to take action against breaches, whether it be a cease and desist letter or a letter demanding information back, or terminating employee who has disclosed information to someone else, or filing suit are all instances in which courts have found information to be adequately protected. Additionally, you want to have regular training on policies, usually every year, to reiterate the policies of the company with relation to confidentiality. And then finally, something that Dawn will touch upon in more detail, conducting exit interviews and documenting those exit interviews to ensure that information is being returned. Another way that you would want to protect information that is going to be disclosed outside of the organization is to put in place non-disclosure agreements with any vendors or third parties with whom the company is doing business. In the current marketplace, we see a lot of companies having consulting agreements with outside providers, but not having confidentiality provisions contained in those, and that's important to do. We're going to move on to what constitutes a trade secret misappropriation, but as this cartoon adequately points out, people are looking to get that information, and so you have to be mindful of that and take adequate means to prevent even the silliest of opportunities for competitors to get their hands on the information. And I particularly like this cartoon. Another thing to keep in mind is where your employees are doing the work. If they're working on highly confidential information, they should be counseled to not do so in public places. So what is actual trade secret misappropriation? Well, trade secret misappropriation is the act of company confidential information that would be subject to reasonable means of protection that is actually still being stolen. Unfortunately, where we see the vast majority of trade secret misappropriation is from employees who have soured on their employment relationship and have decided to leave, or business partners. And unfortunately, the vast majority of that misappropriation is also being done through electronic means. Well, why employees and business partners? Well, they have access to and familiarity with the information and the value of that information. And unfortunately, the technology makes it much easier. In many instances, companies, because of the mobility of their employees, are providing either laptops or portable thumb drives or portable hard drives, and then unfortunately not monitoring the information that's being accessed and not monitoring the ability of those employees to either plug external devices into their computers or email those sensitive documents out to personal email accounts. And this slide just covers a few of the types of devices that we most frequently see. As I mentioned a moment ago, we see external hard drives, thumb drives, but we also see email attachments, and unfortunately now with cloud-based storage, you see lots of options or lots of instances in which employees are using Dropbox or Carbonite or Google Drive and uploading documents there. There's also this concept of threatened misappropriation. In certain states, for example, California, prevent a threat of misappropriation. It's slightly different from inevitable disclosure. An inevitable disclosure is effectively there's an employee who's in the same position they were previously, who had access to confidential information, and they've taken certain steps at the exit of their employment, for example, lying about who they're going to, emailing sensitive documents out, or other things intended to be duplicitous, where courts will say that an employee cannot hold that role with the competitor based on the inevitable disclosure doctrine. But threatened misappropriation is slightly different, and that's in an instance where they've misused or disclosed information in the past, and there's a threat of that information being used in the future. So what remedies are available for threatened misappropriation or actual misappropriation, well, there's monetary damages, there's monetary rewards, including actual damages, unjust enrichment, royalties, punitive damages, certain states that will apply a multiplier for the actual damage, three times, two times, et cetera, and attorney's fees for bad faith or willful misappropriation. There's also injunctive relief that's available in the form of TROs, preliminary injunctions, permanent injunctions, but also royalties that can be applied where damages are difficult to ascertain. And now, since we now have our bit of a primer on what a trade secret is and what trade secret misappropriation constitutes, I'm going to hand over the presentation to Dawn. Dawn is going to focus on steps that employers can take both at both during employment and after employment to continue to protect their trade secrets.
Thank you, Justin. As Justin said, I will be talking a little bit about steps not only during litigation, but steps that employers should be taking well before litigation to protect its trade secrets. And that's a big part of what I'll be talking about today. It will help you down the line when you're actually litigating, and hopefully it will also help you avoid misappropriation to begin with. So you'll see on my first slide the question, reactive versus proactive, when to act. And I'm sure you can guess that we would recommend you be proactive. Don't wait until you suspect that an employee has misappropriated confidential information. You want to be taking steps well in advance of that, well before any high-level employees even leave, in fact, to protect your trade secrets. Employers should have these systems in place basically from day one, and a failure to include such procedures in your employment, in the employment of your high-level employees may cause a court to determine that the employer didn't actually consider its information truly confidential. In addition, that's a potential signal to employees that you don't actually consider certain information that you might think is a trade secret. Employees might think that that's not actually that important if you aren't making that clear from the get-go. So again, you want to start on day one, onboarding interviews. And James will talk about this a little bit later in the context of bringing on employees from a competitor to stave off misappropriation claims. But it's important even for employers who may ultimately end up being plaintiffs in these sorts of cases. You want to convey to your new employees that there's a culture of confidentiality, and you want that to be clear from the very beginning of their employment. But saying that on the first day of employment or as they're signing their agreements isn't enough. You need to communicate the importance of confidentiality throughout the employment. And you can do that by obviously having clear written policies, such as social media and BYOD or bring your own device policies, which I'll be talking about in just a minute. But in addition to having written policies, you may also want to consider conducting regular trainings at various intervals during an employment relationship, and also sending out emails reminding your employees that these policies are in place and that the company takes confidentiality very seriously. You want to show a judge, again, at the end of the day, if this comes to litigation, you want to show a judge and you want to show your employees that confidentiality is serious, you're thinking about it all the time, and you can only do that if you're regularly reminding them of that. As far as BYOD policies, just a few notes here. What you want to do, we know all of our clients have employees who have their own personal phones, and sometimes they can access confidential documents on their phones or company email that might have confidential information. So you should have a policy that provides clear restrictions regarding the use or transfer of trade secrets or confidential information, defines the ownership of that data, and explains the investigation, incident response, and remote wiping procedures. You'll also want to incorporate that into an exit interview process, which I'll talk about in just a few minutes. Another way of communicating the importance of confidentiality during the employment relationship is, as Justin had said just a few minutes ago, marking internal documents appropriately. It's a lot easier to prove to a judge, obviously, that a document is highly confidential if there's a highly confidential stamp on it. So that's an easy measure to take that, again, we don't always see our clients taking, but that's something that you should definitely consider for the most sensitive documents. And of course, you should restrict access to confidential data to those who really only need to see it. You can do that by electronic means, so you might have a separate repository for the most important documents and trade secrets that your organization is seeking to protect, and that repository might only be available to certain employees, certain high-level employees who really need that information, where they need a username and a password that's only provided to them. But also, even though most of our information these days is digital, don't forget about hard copy documents. There may still be documents that contain confidential information or trade secrets that are in hard copy form. So you should have policies on the handling of such documents, whether they can even be printed at all. Sometimes we see clients who have policies that prevent the printing of certain documents, but if they can be printed, they should be stored in very secure places, locked file cabinets, things like that. Another thing that you can do to protect your trade secrets during the employment relationship is to implement company-wide investigative tools well before any wrongdoing occurs. So there are many different systems that you can use, and I've listed some of them here: phone records, badge records, and access logs. And that's particularly important where you have physical documents. As I just mentioned, you might have some documents in a file cabinet in a secure area of your office. You want to have badge records if that's available to you. Tracking systems that can show suspicious email and downloading activity, removable drive activity, which, again, Justin touched on this a little bit before, but we see a lot of this in these cases, people emailing things to their personal email addresses or their new competitor, their new employer email addresses, people plugging USB drives into their computers. So that's important. If you have tracking systems, that can give you a lot of information in advance, letting you know that your employer, your employees are taking steps that you might not consider the best practices for them. And obviously, these are all particularly important where you have the highest level of confidential information. Sometimes we see clients with very, very sophisticated systems where they'll have documents labeled electronically, not even stamped necessarily with highly confidential, but in their document management systems, you know, from 0 to 10 bars showing how sensitive it is. And if an employee emails it to themselves or if they print it when they're not supposed to, you can see easily, okay, this is, you know, a level 10 document. That's obviously very complex and sophisticated, and it might not be right for your organization, but that's the sort of thing that is very helpful later on should litigation occur. Now, I mentioned exit interviews a few minutes ago. These are very important in protecting your trade secrets. This isn't necessary for all employees, but you might want to consider checking an employee's computer activities in advance of the meeting. That's particularly true for high-level employees, those with access to very sensitive information, or employees that you suspect may have been acting nefariously. And that way you go into the meeting knowing what they've been doing the past few days to a week to 2 weeks. Another important part of the exit interview, obviously, is ensuring that all company property, hardware, and devices have been returned. And that includes email and cloud data, social media accounts. And if there are a lot of things, you might want to consider creating an inventory list in advance of the meeting so that you have that at your disposal. You also want to make sure that arrangements are made to have company data removed from personal devices. As I just mentioned, you might have employees who have iPhones or Android phones, and they may have company data on their phones, and you want to make sure that any data that they shouldn't have access to once they leave is taken off those phones. So continuing with the exit interviews, you want to obviously ask the departing employee where they're going. Is their new employer a competitor? What will their new role be? And those will all help you to assess the risk of that employee leaving and determining whether the company's confidential information or trade secrets will provide a benefit to the new employer. And that's obviously a crucial thing to consider when you're assessing the risk of an employee leaving and whether you'll ultimately need to take steps to prevent misappropriation. It's obviously crucial to remind the employee of his or her continuing obligations under their agreements with the company. And in that same vein, you want to identify the sort of information or trade secrets that they had access to or that they used during their employment so that you can remind them that that's the sort of thing that needs to remain confidential, can't be taken with them, can't be disclosed to their new employer or anyone else. In certain circumstances, you may want to consider a letter to the new employer reminding them that their newly hired employee has continuing obligations to your company, and you might want to send that as well to the departing employee, even if you had that conversation during an exit interview. And finally, consider using an exit interview certification. That'll make it a lot easier to just check off the different topics that we just talked about, have the employee sign to confirm that they understood everything. That's just another added layer of protection. Now, when a high-level employee leaves, you likely want to preserve certain data. Now, this may not be required in all circumstances, but particularly with your highest-level employees and those who had access to particularly sensitive information, you obviously want to maintain the records related to the exit interview, and that's probably the case for anyone you conduct an exit interview with. And if the employee's computer or other devices are to be repurposed and given to another employee to use, you should consider creating a forensic mirror image or saving the hard drive. Again, that might not be necessary for all employees, and it might not be feasible from a financial standpoint, but particularly where you're concerned about a particular employee or it's a very high-level employee who had access to the crown jewels, it's a relatively inexpensive measure that can really help you out much later when you conduct an investigation if it comes to that. You should also make sure that the employee's access to the company systems is terminated no later than the last date of an employment. And in some cases, the access should be terminated as of the day that the employee resigns. Again, probably not necessary for every single employee, but you may determine that there are certain employees who have access to very, very sensitive information and trade secrets of the company, and you just can't risk having that person continuing to access those documents for 2 weeks or however long it takes them to transition. So particularly where an employee is going to a competitor or has shown some signs of suspicious activity in the past, you might want to terminate access to those systems right away. Now, where you may have some suspicions about a departing employee, you'll want to take some steps immediately, obviously. Interviewing the employee's coworkers to find out if they know where the person is going, if you weren't able to figure that out during the exit interview, or if they know any competitive activities that their former colleague is engaging in. And a lot of these you'll see are some of the same things I had talked about beforehand that you might use before even conducting an exit interview. But if you haven't done it before the exit interview and you suspect that an employee has engaged in misappropriation or other improper conduct, you should examine the employee's email activity, conduct a forensic investigation, look at badge records, access logs, look at their phone records, check an employee's social media accounts. That's something that you'd be surprised a lot of people share things on social media accounts without realizing that their former employers can see that. And again, I'm beating a dead horse, but this isn't necessary for all employees, but you really want to consider it for those that you're particularly concerned about and when their activities are suspicious. So let's say that you have determined that something untoward has happened and you're marching towards litigation. The first step is to understand the business burden, and that's distinct from the legal burden. As we all know, litigation can be costly, time-consuming, and uncertain, unfortunately. So sometimes it might make sense to send a cease and desist letter first, It may resolve the dispute before any costly litigation ensues, but most likely, if you're worried about your trade secrets, you'll want to get a court order or at least get the wheels rolling to show to your competitor and your former employee that you take this take the actions very seriously and want to maintain your confidential information. Now, litigation can have several goals or motivations, and it's important to discuss that between the business folks, in-house counsel, and outside counsel. So, for example, one thing that we're talking about today, obviously, is injunctive relief. That's probably one of the main goals, but it could be also obtaining monetary damages, ultimately. Retrieving confidential information, enforcing the business's policies. Frankly, sometimes the goal of litigation is simply to send a message to your current or former employees. One other thing that you need to consider is getting the business folks invested and up to speed on the time that will likely be required of them to get pleadings together and the various outcomes. And the flip side of that is it's also just as important to have outside counsel be aware of what the business folks want out of the litigation and make sure everyone's on the same page. So that is definitely a conversation to have in advance. And finally, you'll see the last bullet point on this slide. You want to create a plan in case there's interference with your customers. Most times we find that clients don't want to interview their customers or talk to the customers about the suit specifically because it can make things kind of awkward. And frequently, customers understand that when an employee leaves and steals something, that's going to create a big problem. But they might not understand that someone's simply being prevented from approaching them because of an agreement that they have with their former employer. So you need to just have a plan in advance and consider how to deal with that situation. And sometimes, obviously, we know that former employees will badmouth their former employer to the customers. So a response and damage control is important to have, if not formally, then at least informally. So now as for the legal burden, obviously at the injunction stage, particularly in these sorts of cases, the analysis is very fact-specific. So the facts are very important, and that's why that's the first bullet point on this slide. As I said earlier, forensic investigations, to the extent they're available to you, can provide you a lot of information very easily, and that's something that's great to have in your pleadings to show the judge exactly what happened. So that's why it's particularly important if you have a mirror image of a former employee's hard drive. That's very important information. But also, having witness interviews with the former employee's colleagues. And it's important to identify key players, not only to get all the facts that you'll need for your pleadings, but also, frankly, that will be important when you're sending out a litigation or IT hold letter. You want to make sure that everyone is keeping any information that could be helpful to the case. And as far as interviewing key players, that could be trying to get information related to the employee's departure, their new employer, their access to confidential information or trade secrets, and the nature of the confidential information and trade secrets. So you might be interviewing a broad variety of employees, from tech folks down to HR personnel. The next tip is to communicate the business. Don't assume that a judge is going to understand what your company does. You need to make it very clear what the employee was doing and how his or her new position is competing and how the trade secret that you claim that they have misappropriated will help them in their new position. And that goes to the next bullet point. Be prepared to articulate the trade secret. It's very important in these cases, obviously, to explain to the judge what the trade secret is and why it's worthy of trade secret protection. This is particularly true with highly complex technology. It's a big mistake to assume that because the technology is so difficult to understand that the judge will just throw up his or her hands and agree then it must be a trade secret. You need to find a way to explain to the judge what the information is. But the hard part is you don't want to give away too much, obviously. It is a trade secret. It is confidential information. You can't disclose all of that. So you may want to consider offering an in-camera review, but you have to be prepared for a judge who won't allow you to do this. So again, it's a fine balance between articulating what the trade secret is and what the confidential information is that you claim your former employee took, with the business reality of not wanting to disclose too much information. Now, the final bullet point I have on this slide is try to always wear the white hat. And of course, what we mean by that is you always want to look like the good guy when you're asking for injunctive relief. A lot of judges are not willing to grant injunctive relief easily. So you want to make it seem like you are eminently reasonable and the other side is the only side that has done anything bad. Sometimes, unfortunately, we can't avoid that there are bad facts, but certainly as soon as you suspect some foul play, you need to make sure that you're doing everything you can in your power to look like the one wearing the white hat. Some additional considerations in obtaining injunctive relief. Obviously, you need to be prepared to articulate why damages, monetary damages, would be inadequate. You need to show that there's irreparable harm without an injunction, so that's obviously something that cannot be overlooked. Timing is also very important. You want to move quickly because you want to show the judge that this is an important matter and that if he or she doesn't grant an injunction, you will be irreparably harmed. But obviously, it's a balancing act, and you need to make sure that you have enough facts in your pleadings to also convince the judge that this is what needs to happen. So it can sometimes be a fine line between taking the time to gather all of your facts and making sure that you're moving quick enough so that the judge doesn't say, you know, why weren't you in here a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago? Why did you wait so long? Consider the relief that you're asking for. Again, as I said, a lot of judges are hesitant to award injunctive relief, so you want to make sure that you're being reasonable. Now, that's not to say that you should give up certain requests that you think are necessary to protect your company's trade secrets, but you want to make sure that you are looking reasonable in what you're asking. And just a couple additional notes on this slide. Justin had briefly talked about New York and Massachusetts being the outliers in that they haven't adopted the Uniform Trade Secret Act. So the Uniform Trade Secret Act can protect against actual or threatened misappropriation. In Massachusetts, for sure, and I believe New York as well, James might be able to speak to that, you don't automatically get protection against threatened misappropriation. So in Massachusetts, for example, when you're bringing a misappropriation case, you need to really be able to show that something has been misappropriated. One caveat, you can use the threatened misappropriation piece in the irreparable harm prong of the injunctive relief test. So let's say, for example, you can show that one particular document was misappropriated. There might be tons of other documents that you think are at risk of being misappropriated, and you can talk about those to show that without injunctive relief, irreparable harm will likely occur. But that's something to be aware of. And then finally, inevitable disclosure. Where recognized, it allows a court to bar an employee from working where misappropriation and duplicitous conduct exists. So this, for example, might be the case where you're saying that an employee, by going to a competitor, will inevitably disclose even with the best of intentions. Finally, the last piece here, other considerations. Be prepared to post a bond, but also be aware that sometimes we've seen bond waiver provisions in contracts enforced, so you might want to include that in your employment agreements. What happens once the judge makes his decision or her decision? If you have obtained a temporary restraining order or preliminary injunction, that could be leveraged for settlement. We often see these cases settle as soon as an injunction is awarded. Or your company may decide that it's important to continue with the litigation. It's probably going to be timely or time-consuming and costly, but that may be something that your company is willing to do to send a message. Now, if you fail to obtain an injunction, it's not necessarily the end of the case. It makes it a lot harder. It makes settlement certainly a lot harder because the defendant is often emboldened. But again, it might be something that's worth it for your company if you really feel that at the end of the day, you'll get monetary damages or an injunction later on, then you should consider that. You should also simultaneously move for expedited discovery so that you can get to the bottom of what happened and truly figure out if there's a basis to continue going forward. And then finally, my last little note here, you should have a plan B, or really plan A version 2.0, as you'll see, other intellectual property protections. So if the departing employee was involved in a sensitive research and development project and is going to a competitor, consider whether to engage patent counsel to get patent applications on file to seek protection of the intellectual property that the employee is working on, or that could be useful to the competitor. Likewise, if the employee was involved in software development, you might want to involve IP counsel to consider a copyright application filing that could further action to preclude the use of software that the employee may end up using at their new job for a competitor. And with that, I will hand it over to James.
Thanks, Dawn. First, before I begin, I just need to read out the CLE code. To receive one credit of CLE for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form, which will be emailed to you at the end of this week. The code is SSO802. Dawn just spoke extensively about employing best practices to protect against trade secret misappropriation and the nuts and bolts of litigating a trade secrets case as a plaintiff. What I'm going to cover is generally defending against trade secret misappropriate allegations, specifically best practices for hiring new employees and consultants from a company that might be viewed as a competitor. And in the event you find yourself, unfortunately, a defendant to a trade secrets lawsuit or are confronted with a cease and desist letter, a general overview of some of the defense strategies that should be considered. There is, of course, no absolute way, no matter how careful you are, and no matter how closely you monitor inbound hires, particularly if you're a larger company, to protect yourself against a trade secrets lawsuit. The best that you can hope to do is to minimize risk, and that entails employing best practices when hiring new employees and sound corporate governance. In simplest terms, the best way to avoid trade secret liability is to ensure that your company's employees do not misuse misuse another company's information. Dawn spoke extensively about a culture of confidentiality to protect information from leaving the company, and that applied equally when protecting against any possible inbound information. That kind of culture ensures that all employees from top to bottom are guarding against information belonging to outsiders from infecting the company. That culture and maintaining that culture generally starts with carefully vetting new hires and at the interview process. Whenever you are considering an employee from a competitor, you obviously want to research where that former employee came from in advance of that interview. By doing that research, you can uncover a lot of evidence as to whether or not that company is extremely litigious. Obviously, that's a red flag that you should note if you are planning on hiring that employee from a litigious company. You can easily do that by doing searches online on PACER to determine if they've been plaintiffs in trade secrets lawsuits. And then when you finally do determine that you want to bring the interviewee in, you want to make sure you don't talk about who that specifically, the customers that that employee worked with, or any specific trade secrets or any ongoing projects that they were working on. That you rather you want to just keep it to general skills and talents and to avoid crossing that line where they may be talking about trade secrets that could get your company into trouble. You obviously want to make clear that the employee should not under any circumstances use or bring any of his former employees' information to solicit any former coworkers. You should check if the employee has any agreements before making an offer and review them with your in-house legal counsel. And when I say any agreements, this is not just employment agreements. You want to obviously know if they have any stock option agreements, because a lot of times these stock option agreements will also contain trade secrets or confidentiality obligations, as well as non-competes. And sometimes those stock options are also tied to the non-competes. You should consider if there is a non-compete or a confidentiality obligation or a non-solicitation agreement, to reach out to the employer's employee's former employer, or require that the employee gain a waiver of any non-compete agreement prior to hiring, if you're really concerned about a potential lawsuit. When you're reviewing a former employee's or an inbound employee's former employment agreement, you should obviously be aware of any restrictive covenants. And the first thing you need to determine to yourself is, are these covenants enforceable? Most jurisdictions adopt a standard where the restrictive covenant must be narrowly tailored to protect a legitimate interest. And a lot of people automatically look at the geographic and temporal restrictions to determine whether or not it's overbroad or reasonable. But you should first ask, did the employee have a role where he or she actually had access to trade secrets? And sometimes, particularly with rank and file employees, the answer is no. You want to be able to be sure that you differentiate between a non-solicit and a non-compete. Be careful for non-solicit that bar solicitation of customers generally, as opposed to customers with whom the prospective employee had a relationship, because a lot of times the non-solicitation provision doesn't specify specifically, but the latter but both the former and the latter can be enforceable in some jurisdictions. And you also want to be aware of any choice of law or venue considerations. For example, a lot of times California companies believe that if they hire a resident of California, that a non-compete in that former employee or that employee's prior agreement is not enforceable, not knowing that it contains a choice of law or a choice of venue provision for another state that is enforceable. And if the non-compete is enforceable, you want to first, to avoid a lawsuit, you want to see if it's possible to find a position and tailor that position for the employee that does not violate the restrictive covenant. The rule of thumb is that the more similar the role, the more suspect the former employee will be, the former employer will be, that the employee will be in a role where he will be in violation of his non-compete or his or her non-compete agreement, or possibly inevitably use any confidential information, even if it may only be in his head. And that's where we get into the inevitable disclosure doctrine. And as I talked about earlier, if you had done your research about researching the former employer, you can look to see if the competitor regularly enforces their restrictive covenants. We talked earlier about creating a culture where employers understand the confidentiality and what information that the company needs to protect the confidential information. And one of the other things that you want to do with onboarding new employees is you want to conduct new hire training on the importance of protecting company trade secrets to maintain that culture. And obviously, during this training, you should the training should apply across the board. You want to emphasize the importance of non-disclosure and trade secret protection agreements so that employees can be guarded against any inbound information from possibly infecting the company. And I use the word infecting because a lot of times, once information does come into the company, it usually comes in electronically, whether or not an employee might bring in a zip drive, for example. And once it's onto your computers and you get involved yourself defending a trade secret misappropriation lawsuit, then suddenly there's going to be allegations that once it's on your company system, it's basically infected the entire network. And you'll be facing with an extensive e-discovery lawsuit where you're going to have to preserve a host of computers as well as your servers to make sure that that information hasn't gone any further or been misused in any way. For particularly sensitive hires, you want to routinely follow up with the employee to ensure that he or she is honoring their restrictive covenants. And one of the ways that you can protect yourself against any potential inbound information is to include in offer letters and make your inbound employees sign as a condition of employment not to use any former employer's trade secrets. I've included, and I kind of want to get through this very quickly because I know we're short on time, but there are some private practitioner considerations for developing an exit strategy if you're representing particular individual employees. And this also applies if you're HR and you want to give some suggestions or tips to an inbound employee, what can they do to make sure that they leave on good terms with their prior employer? Some of these steps include you want to make sure that the employee notifies their former employer of their resignation in a timely fashion. The less suspect it appears when an employee leaves, the less suspect the circumstances, the less likely it is that the employer will be inclined to sue the employee. You want to prepare a professional resignation letter and provide the former employer with a description of what it is that you'll be doing, where you're going to be going. You heard Dawn earlier speak about how sometimes if an employee lies about where they're going, that will obviously trigger a negative reaction from the employer, a former employer. So if you're open and honest, it's less likely that the former employer will be concerned. You obviously should instruct your client if you're representing the former employee, or you should instruct any inbound hires to not keep, remove, photocopy, or download any company information. And if they do have any information, whether at home or in their car or if they work abroad, they should assemble all of that property that belonged to the company and make arrangements for its return. Most of the data today that is claimed to be misappropriated is in electronic format. And oftentimes what happens, whenever an employer reviews the emails of an outgoing employee, they're going to find a lot of instances where that employee emailed information to a personal email account. And 9 times out of 10, a defense that I've come across in prosecuting these cases or when representing defendants in these cases is that the defendant claims, well, I was emailing it to my home address because I was working at nights from home and it was hard to use Citrix, it was too slow, and more often than not, that's the case. So if your client or if the outgoing employee at the time that he was leaving really did have a lot of information in his personal email accounts, you want to arrange for their return, be upfront with the former employer, and tell them that you have all this information, put it on a CD or a zip drive before deleting any of it, and say, make arrangements for their return. If it's extensive, one of the things that we've sometimes suggested to the outgoing employee is to hire a forensic consultant to arrange for the removal of any company data that may be in their home computer or any personal electronic devices. The outgoing employee should avoid any unusual activities, such as going to the office late at night, downloading or printing large volumes of information before they leave, because you have to assume that all of this is going to be monitored and heavily scrutinized. And obviously, the employee should be instructed to not solicit any clients, not to speak to any clients or customers about where they're going or their new position unless you've given that authorization from the employer. And if asked about opportunities by other employees, sometimes you'll have a colleague say, oh, do they have any job openings available? They should obviously not comment because more than likely than not, the employee is subject to a non-solicitation agreement. If you're in HR and the employee is subject to an employment agreement with their prior employer, you may want to help them develop a transition plan and that employee should also help train a new incoming employee into that position to make sure that the transition is seamless. And finally, the employee should avoid using any social media to discuss the transition. A lot of times, a former employer, if they haven't been told where the employee is going, will find out on Twitter or on LinkedIn suddenly that they're in the exact same role that they had with a new competing company. And if they haven't been upfront about where they're going, and if they're out there connecting with all of their clients and customers as to what it is they're doing, this is all red flags that would likely result in a lawsuit that should be avoided. And in the unfortunate circumstances of where you find yourself on the other side of the V, there are certain strategies that ought to be considered to minimize the litigation liability. First off, as a matter of course, as soon as you get hit with a complaint or a cease and desist letter, you should immediately have any computers that are in the defendant's possession, and when I say defendant, I mean the employee, and that includes both his work computer and his home computer, as well as any iPads or any company-issued iPhones that he has in his possession, all preserved so that he can continue working in his current role without any fear that any information will be deleted or altered. And arguably, you have that obligation irrespective, under the federal rules, irrespective of whether or not that is ultimately demanded by your adversary. If the plaintiff is moving for an injunction, one of the ways you can seek to minimize litigation costs, particularly if you're taking the, quote, I have nothing to hide approach, or if you believe strongly that your employee has not done anything wrong, or if you know that your employee has inadvertently taken some confidential information with them, for example, they've emailed this information to themselves, you should consider consenting to a non-use of that information or returning that information to their prior employer, or consenting to a limited modified injunction that is either client-specific, for example, I won't go after, you know, your top five clients, or something that is geographically specific. For example, if you know that the former employer had a strong presence in New York, for example, then you will agree that you will stay out of New York, but you will continue working in some of the neighboring states. And immediately upon getting a cease and desist letter, it's always worth picking up the phone and talking to your adversary and finding out what proof that they have of misappropriation. Find out specifically what it is they're claiming was taken so that you can take steps to remedy the situation. So I know we're short on time, but I just want to run through some of the various defenses that can be asserted when you do decide to litigate as opposed to trying to work out a consent injunction. Number one is the plaintiff has the burden to prove that there's a protectable interest. And a lot of times what's alleged to be misappropriated doesn't rise to the level of trade secret protection. If you review the former employer's website, for example, you might find that they actually list a wealth of information, including who it is, what customers they work with, the amount of business that they do, and what projects that they're working on right now. That's all helpful information to show that this information is publicly available or they don't take steps to protect it. Sometimes what's claimed to be misappropriated may be several years old and is stale and, you know, not worth it, and therefore not subject to trade secret protection. Sometimes the information that they claim is misappropriated, you already have that information, or you already have an ongoing relationship with that same customer that they're claiming that you can't solicit. And you know, some of the steps that Dawn spoke about earlier in terms of making sure that you take steps to protect that confidential information by marking documents confidential, a lot of times if you do enough fact investigation of the former employer during discovery, you'll find that the former employer didn't take any of those steps, and therefore these are some of the defenses that would help resolve the litigation. In order to get an injunction, a former employer has to show, in addition to likelihood of success on the merits, in most jurisdictions, you have to show irreparable harm. And sometimes you can make the argument that monetary damages are a sufficient remedy. If we're talking about a solicited customer that has done a certain amount of business with the new employer and that new customer only maybe brought in $5,000 of revenue and they already have an injunction in place that employer or an agreement in place rather that you're not going to go after that new customer ever again, then their damages are arguably are only that $5,000 of new business that came in. You want to develop facts that would balance the hardships in your client's favor, or in the employee's favor, rather. The employee may be the sole breadwinner of their family, and these are some of the equitable factors that will that judges strongly consider, because more often than not, a judge is not going to want to, or they're going to be very reluctant to, put an employee out of work, particularly in these trying economic times. Oftentimes, if an employer has a very broad non-compete and they know they have a broad non-compete, they'll try to go into court and say, well, we're not going to try to enforce this non-compete as written, but what we'll do is we're just trying to enforce the non-compete as limited to only these particular states. Well, that's not what the non-compete says, or that's not sometimes they'll try to narrowly tailor a non-compete into a non-solicitation. If it's a non-compete that's overly broad, you should point out that out to the court, and they can't come in and rewrite it, particularly in states that don't recognize blue penciling or reformation. And finally, you should consider some of the defenses relating to the plaintiff's own conduct. How did they obtain this trade secret information? Do they regularly also hire employees from their competitors to bring in this information? Is there an estoppel claim that can be asserted? For example, they only go after certain employees but not others, and they've allowed certain employees to take information to other competitors. These are all considerations that should be explored if you're ever facing allegations of trade secret misappropriation. So I just want to close by saying that you can obviously talk to each of us more about some of the topics that we've covered. In addition, you should visit www.tradesecretslaw.com for SciFarth's trade secrets blog. And with that, I don't think we have any time for questions, but I'll send it back to the panel.
Well, we'll cover them for anyone who wants to stick around, but we did have a number of people who raised some issues with the passcode for today, so we'll repeat that one more time. That is S as in Sam, 0802. Again, that's S as in Sam, 0802. The first question that we have is asking about whether it is proper to require an exiting employee to disclose their next employer and how far down the chain of subsequent moves it's permissible to do so. It's absolutely, we recommend including in any employment agreement certain notice provisions as it relates to end of employment. Some employers will put in 30 days notice, some employers will put in 14 days notice, but in any event, it's absolutely proper to require them to disclose who their subsequent employer is going to be. It's entirely appropriate to also include if they are subsequently employed during the life of that non-compete. If it's a one-year non-compete, you can certainly require them to disclose who their employer is during the course of that one-year non-compete. Outside of that non-compete time frame, you'll run into some issues. You can include it in the agreement, but it doesn't mean that you're going to have any remedy if they fail to abide by that. The second question we have is a tough one. It's how is economic value assessed with respect to trade secrets that are misappropriated? From the standpoint of simply defining what economic value is, oftentimes it's based on the facts alleged, and you're looking at a piece of information and you're effectively going to need testimony from someone inside the company to say, this is a valuable piece of information, this is how we would use it, this is how it, you know, it has value to the company. If you're looking from the standpoint of how does one particular document, what is the value of one particular document if you're looking for damages, that's a tougher thing, and what courts are typically looking at are the totality of the circumstances. And basically, you know, what's the business that's been lost? What are the opportunities that have been lost? What damage was inflicted purely by that document leaving the control of the company? Oftentimes, it's impossible to put a monetary value on it, and that's why injunctive relief is available to plaintiffs. Dawn, did you want to address the next couple questions that we had?
Sure. We had a question about what happens when IT professionals who have access to trade secret files or other confidential information and are tasked with the implementation and enforcement of policies around trade secrets, what happens when they leave? Now, IT professionals are unlikely to have the same sorts of employment agreements as some of your other employees. I would imagine they are unlikely to have non-competes or non-solicits, but they absolutely should be bound by confidentiality. So I would certainly recommend having some sort of agreement that expresses that the information that they're dealing with is confidential and they can't remove it. We also had another question about when the HR group or others inside a company should contact outside counsel or forensic investigators when they suspect wrongdoing. And unfortunately, there's not an easy answer to that. It really depends on the information that you have. Now, if your company has really robust, sophisticated systems and you have a lot of information that leads you to believe that something bad happened, I would say, you know, call up outside counsel or a forensic expert pretty quickly because you have a lot of evidence there. If you don't have a lot of systems, you might want to spend a little bit more time trying to corral the information internally. But again, it's important not to wait too long, lest it appear that you're not that concerned. So sooner is always better, I would say, in these situations.
And we have two last questions. James, did you want to handle those?
Sure. I'm just trying to read the question in this window. Can you read them out to me? Because I'm having trouble with the...
Sure. And the first question, I think the gist of it is, are there limitations that exist from a legal standpoint as to the extent of which a restrictive covenant can limit future employment with a potential competitor?
So I'm still trying to read the question here. can you just repeat that one more time? Sorry.
The gist of the question is from a legal standpoint, are there limitations on the enforcement of by an employer of a former employee from an industry or geographic location or time perspective?
Sure. There's certainly limitations on enforcement. If you're talking about in the letter agreement between, this is the question, right? The letter agreement between the employer and the employee with respect to restrictive covenants limiting employment with potential competitors. Obviously, you need to, as I said earlier, every single restrictive covenant in order to be enforced has to be narrowly tailored to protect a legitimate business interest. So first and foremost is it has to be tied to some sort of protection of a trade secret. If you don't have a trade secret, then it doesn't matter how broad or restrictive the covenant may be, it's not going to be enforced. The second thing is when we use the term narrowly tailored, it needs to be specific in terms of geographic scope and temporally speaking, but more also needs to be tied to whether or not it's actually relevant to what the employee was doing. So if the employee, for example, if you have a worldwide non-compete, or let's make it a little easier, if you have a non-compete that's limited to the United States and you have an employee who only works in, say, the state of Texas, it's going to be very difficult to say that the non-compete should be enforced against the employee because he didn't work in any other state in Texas, and arguably it's overly broad because he can't work anywhere else in the United States.
I think that's all the time we have for today. Thank everyone on the call who participated by lodging a question. If you have any trade secrets questions or concerns arising out of either this webinar or going forward, please feel free to reach any of us. Our contact information is attached, and we will be distributing by the end of the week the slide deck. So if you have any concerns, questions, or needs, feel free to contact any of us. But thank you for your time, and have a great rest of your day.
And thank you to all our speakers. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.